Welcome to Common Work, Learnings for the Future from Common Field. This is the organization's final project as it closes in December 2022. In this four-part podcast and writing series, we'll explore what we've learned together through the life, work, and closing of Common Field, a network-centered arts nonprofit organization. You'll also hear about artist-centered work pushing our field forward today, and our dreams for the future of creative sustainability from network members across the country. Each podcast episode is paired with commissioned writings from Ikram Lakhdar, writer and former Common Field staff member, Racing Magpie co-founder Mary Bordeaux with artist Clementine Bordeaux, Allison Friedman Weisberg and Sean Leonardo, co-directors of Recess, and Common Field board members Sarah Williams and Jackie Clay. You can access these writings, additional episodes in the series, and project materials for Common Work, Learnings for the Future on commonfield.org through April 2023. Beyond that, you can access the project in full on our platform partner websites, including Jack Straw Cultural Center and Lohar Projects. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Episode 1, Foundations. This episode will explore the history of artist organizing that inspired Common Field and the nature and work of founding arts organizations. This episode includes conversations between Roberto Bedoya, Cultural Affairs Manager for the City of Oakland, and Sheetal Prajapathy, Executive Director of Common Field, on the history of organizing in the field, and on the work of creating new places and spaces for our creative efforts with James McAnally, co-founder and former board member of Common Field and artistic director of Counter Public in St. Louis, Missouri, with Anne Duplan, writer and co-founder of the Center for Afrofuturist Studies in Iowa City, Iowa. And now, Roberto and Sheetal.
Roberto, it's so nice to be in conversation with you. I'm Sheetal. Right now, I'm the executive director here at Common Field, but Roberto, we've known each other for quite some time, right?
Yes. I don't know how long ago, 15, 20 years ago?
15, 20 years ago. We were in graduate school together at the School of the Art Institute. So I would love it if you could just tell us a little bit about you and how you define the work that you do in our field.
I've been in the field good 40 plus years, always working in nonprofit artist-centered organizations. I've had many different sort of hats I've worn, started off as an artist as well, writing here in the Bay Area, had a job with CETA, a Comprehensive Extensive Training Act, which is important to know was a jobs program that also fed the development of the alternative space movement of the 70s. From there, I went to Intersection for the Arts in San Francisco. So then went to New York, tried to be an artist, came back to California, ran Los Angeles Contemporary Exhibitions for a moment, an alternative space, and then ultimately at the Getty Research Institute doing cultural programming. When I was in San Francisco, I was at Intersection for the Arts and became a board member of the National Association of Artist Organizations. I raise that point because I think it was a network of alternative spaces. It was an effort to organize artists doing work that was about empowering talent and empowering communities, which I think kind of speaks to my own motivations.
Yeah. I think that's a good segue into talking about going back to the roots of artist organizing and kind of the social and political environments that led to those moments and this kind of work.
I always see artists organizing themselves in the context of the empowerment movements of the 60s and 70s, people of color, gays and lesbians, queer artists, all kind of committed to an ethos of self-determination and butting up against the powers that be. So in the artist community, it was like, let's start these DIY nonprofit art spaces. And they were doing work that was not so tied to the market. It was the beginning of installation work, performance art, all these kind of cultural practices that were not embraced by the museum world or the marketplace. That was my scene, the alternative art world. I was always very mindful of what it was, what were the conditions for artists of color at this moment in time.
Can you talk a little bit about not just the form of the work, you know, ephemeral, performative work that didn't really fit into collection-based practice, but the content? What were artists making work about at that time? In some ways necessitated a space outside of these spaces.
Sure. It goes back to what my characterization of the emancipation movement. So they were talking about race and racism. They were talking about feminism. They were talking about gay liberation. All of these artists were dealing with subject matter that was sort of counter narratives than what the mainstream was supporting. God bless artists and that DIY spirit, they started to make their own spaces. And believe it or not, there was a moment in time when the National Endowment for the Arts was supportive of this work through the Seed Arts program, and then support these emerging spaces, these delicate spaces, these artist-centered organizations.
The work of creating a space that was open enough to welcome all of those perspectives also quite important for certain groups of artists that you've identified. I would love it if you could just take a minute to share a little bit about what your role was at NAO, what you did there, and then talk a little bit more about that advocacy piece that NAO was so critically a part of in the 80s around the culture wars.
Sure. I was on the board of NAO, National Association Artists Organizations, for many years, and I was thinking earlier about, you know, the NEA believed in emerging art forms, and they had a division called InterArts, which was sort of performance art, but also, you know, dance. And all of these organizations came together and were members of the National Association of Artists Organizations. And the NEA supported NAO mainly through its role as a convener. So we would have national conferences that were always fun and really energetic. And we were based in Washington, D.C. And then when the cultural war started to happen, it was artists that were part of my membership that were being attacked by Jesse Helms and the far right for their content. They filed a lawsuit because they were denied their fellowships by the chairman at the NEA at that time. And they sued to get their money back. And we, the National Association of Artists Organizations, a network, also joined that lawsuit, mainly arguing that the organizations that presented these artists were also being penalized, being denied grants. So there was a chilling effect around a law that Congress had passed called Standards of Decency Language that was part of the criteria that the NEA had to use in their deliberation processes. So we challenged that Standards of Decency Language. So we spent about 10 years in the courts and went to the Supreme Court, and we didn't win the lawsuit because we had no standing, and I put that in quotes, meaning that the Standards of Decency Language had never been applied to deny artists or arts organization their monies. And the other effect that it had upon the agency was the government got rid of its fellowship program.
because you were on the board of NAIO and also at the helm of it during different periods of its life, for you as an arts worker and even thinking about what you do now, for you, what was important about NAIO or the field?
I love the arts. What comes to the foreground of Patti Smith and her line, outside is the side I take. That's where I want to be. So in some ways, I always loved kind of artists that worked outside of the margin. But it was a movement to find peer support for experimentation, for discovery, for imagination.
You currently work as the cultural affairs manager at the City of Oakland in the context of the city and government. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about why working in the ways that you're working now, like post-NAIO.
Sure, I can tell you a little about that, but let me talk a little bit about NAIO. I think when I left, I was just exhausted. But also, what I realized is that, and you probably know this, it was financially very difficult because basically you're trying to organize a poor constituency. My membership dues could not pay what it meant to have an office and staff to do that. And the philanthropic support was there for a moment in time because we were associated with a lawsuit. And then when the lawsuit got resolved, that money just kind of disappeared. Kind of weakness that led to the demise of that or led to the fading away of that network. I find myself intellectually sort of thinking about cultural policy, how it's formed, what kind of policy you want to make, the policy arguments necessary to move a concept forward, the organizing that you had to do, and all of a sudden, you know, there I was in government. Government is complicated. It's very bureaucratic and difficult sometimes.
Working in those spaces where you see the most possibility for making these kinds of policy changes?
Yes and no. I mean, I think about governance and not government, first of all. So NAIO was a form of governance. I still feel that governance, how does my city organize itself around community and cultural development? It's very important. I mean, the thing about cultural policy, we need to be mindful of that culture is fluid, it's always changing and unfolding. So as a government bureaucrat, I need to make sure that my policies don't strangle folk, but actually support folk.
Do you have a sense or a feeling about impact in relation to scale?
Sure. We live in a moment, a new kind of localism has a lot of power right now. I'm on the ground and I think about governance, I think about government, I think about democracy a lot. And what does democracy look like? I believe in government as a form, if we can imagine it. This I'm going to refer to a political philosopher named Chantal Mouffe. And the notion of democracy as a chain of equivalences. How do those equivalences work? That's a homework assignment of democracy.
What I was thinking about while you were talking about democracy as a way of moving through something, what do you think the role of the artist is in this support of democracy, participation in democracy?
Sure. I think an awful lot of a civic imagination, what that is, how do we imagine our lives together, and how do we employ song, movement, gestures, all of these things that help us think about our lives together. I think one of the challenges of America is this ethos that of the I at the expense of the we. So individualization is like, yeah, I'm going to go out and make my fortune. Yeah, I'm going to make it in New York. And it's not to deny the I, but the I exists in context of a we, an us.
You know, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And part of the reason that I even considered coming on to this role at Common Field was because I was starting to think about the potential of actually building collective practice. To me, Common Field seemed in some ways like an expression of the ideal. One of the things that I thought was beautiful about the way Common Field started was that it not only was started by people that were doing work in the field, but its founding board and its board members since then were all practitioners. And that gave the organization a leadership model that I felt curious about. And at the same time, that model didn't allow for the organization to financially sustain itself. So on one hand, this like work of collective action was actually happening, but the structure for supporting it just didn't exist. How do we translate collective thought or collective ideals into actual action?
A couple of things come to mind. How can we imagine different kinds of networks? What does a network look like if you want to be a network of care? So the language of intersectionality that is kind of closely linked with emancipation movements demand a different kind of network.
I agree with you, Roberto, and I think you brought up another point that's worth reflecting on, considering this is a newer moment for many, many artists and administrators of color. You, Roberto, are one of the only examples, I'm not exaggerating, for most of my career, of a person of color that was in a leadership role that I could actually point to.
Yeah, there's truth to that, and I understood that.
And one of the things that I think about a lot, because I am of this moment where I've been able to bring artists of color into the spaces I've worked in ways that weren't possible. And as that is happening, what I've found is that there's still not good infrastructure for supporting those folks once they get into those spaces. Do you think the proliferation of folks of color having more visibility across the field and even in the market will change these systems?
It's a great question. You tell me what you find out. You know, I worked at the Getty. I loved working at the Getty. They were really good to me. But it's not an organization of color. It's white space. I don't demonize the big guys. I understand that they're different. And so I look at people of color that are in that field of opera and symphony and museum world, and more power to them. And how do they figure out their relationships to the activist community, to race and racism in America?
What you're saying really resonates with me, which is that we are in these kind of unique positions of both having opportunities in a way maybe folks like us haven't had before, but also having to do self-reflection on where we want to sit in this space. For a long time, I was like, I'm going to work in museums, try to change that. And then I got to MoMA and I was like, that's not the work I want to do.
I'm glad you had a moment, like I had a moment at Getty. Yeah. But, you know, it goes back to a driving force. Artists, what do artists want? What do artists' support systems look like? They want money to do work. They want health care. They want a variety of basic sort of needs. And what is the organizing that needs to kind of advance and support artists? They think about self-care. I want to go back to, if I could imagine a new network, it would be grounded in networks of care, but also networks that prompt civic imagination.
There's a lot more visibility around the dialogue of what does it mean to support an artist in a holistic way? There's an ecosystem of support that they need in order to not just do their work, but to live and do their work.
And trying to figure out how do you animate a social movement of belonging. Belonging is like this big North Star in my career, and I've done a lot of work around that. What does that look like? Those are things I reflect upon.
And now, on Founding Organizations with James and Ann.
Well, James, my name is Ann Dupin. I use he, they pronouns, and I am the co-director / program coordinator of the Center for Afrofuturist Studies, as well as a postcolonial literature professor at Bennington College. And I'll let you introduce yourself, James.
James McAnally. I use he, him pronouns. I am the executive and artistic director of Counter Public, which is a triennial civic exhibition based in St. Louis. For the purpose of this conversation, I'm also a founder of the Luminary Independent Space in St. Louis and one of the early founding members of Common Field.
Well, institution building is a pretty specific thing to get into. And I wonder if you could describe when you first became interested in that.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I feel like if I could describe myself as anything, it is kind of an institution builder. Institutional practice would be the closest form of practice that I could identify with at this point. My first experience was in founding the Luminary, which was its kind of earliest roots were in 2007. I moved to St. Louis having grown up in Mississippi, and I was a musician and a music writer. And in St. Louis, it's a pretty disaggregated place. People's studios are in their homes. There aren't that many places to gather, and fell into it in that way, just really like looking to be with other artists caused me to found an organization. And then from there, it was really about asking questions. And I find myself drawn to spaces of lack or something that is maybe missing, and to think, what can I do to address that in some kind of way? And I think that that central thread has run throughout everything else that follows.
I definitely relate to falling into it, and it makes me think of when I was first thinking up the CAST program, and I sort of like proposed that we like buy this house. And I don't know, the first kind of even prototype version of it was like $75,000 just to start, which tells you kind of how little experience I had with fundraising. There's like a double-edged sword to falling into it, where if I knew how much it was going to take to pull off from the start, I probably wouldn't have done it, or I would have done it differently. But then also there was a real benefit to kind of just finding ourselves in the middle of it and needing to find the money, which we did, you know, and like it worked out. That starting energy feels like a little bit of ignorance is maybe a good thing. How in the know did you feel as far as how institutions actually work and how to run them?
I likewise had no idea what I was doing. Yeah. And it's one of those common questions, would you do it again? And it was an easy answer, like, no way. There's no way I would do it again. But also I couldn't. There's no way to get back to that founding moment. And I think, there's not really a way to like explain its emergence in a way that is any kind of model. And I'm curious if you experience this too, where like people come to you and ask for like help or insight, like, when they're looking for advice.
Usually it's the kind of query I get a lot is like from other people who want to start residencies for Black and Brown artists. And even within the field of like the residency, there's so many deviations, and there's places that make you pay them, and there's places that'll pay you, and there's places where you can bring your kids and places where you can't. And so I just start by like making that landscape clear. There's the like limitless possibilities for what a residency is. And the fact that like in my case with the CAST program lives within Public Space One, which is an organization that I think by the time that I met them was already 15 years old. I don't think that I would be able to sustain the CAST program if it wasn't already housed within another organization.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't know that anything I do is a model, but like, as far as models go, one in which you can collaborate or be embedded with other people is almost always better. And I think that's really like resonant. It's really a smart strategy that also puts you in dialogue with other people from the beginning.
Yeah. And it also speaks to the nature of PS1 as an organization, because the program itself started as like a 2-year artist project. I was the artist, kind of my project. And then by virtue of the scale of what ended up happening, it stopped making sense for it to be my project even, you know, and then became just kind of part of the landscape of PS1. As you know, like in terms of like institutional structures, there's a lot of conversations that have to happen as far as like, am I an employee? Am I a contractor? And am I an artist? Am I getting paid? Where's the money coming from? And we had to have a lot of conversations about the value structures that were embedded in our institutional structure. The Luminary, was it pretty clear from the beginning how we all should be structured, or did you have to sort of arrive at that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we made at the Luminary a pretty early decision that we needed to be a nonprofit. But early on, it was actually meant to be create a container that kind of exists outside of any individual. And so it was a conscious choice to kind of formalize maybe like 2 years in. If you're trying to create something that is long running, that it's sort of the form you have to engage with. That's the simple version. The more complicated answer is that at some point, say 2011, there was a point in which we were a nonprofit, we were a for-profit, and then we were running a publication that we called Anti-Profit, which was almost entirely like operating in through a barter system. So at any given moment, you would like look at it and we're engaging in multiple economic models at the same time, because none of them worked. None of them were complete, and none of them really like represented what we did.
I'm really struck by that, the being like at least three things at once. Can you talk about the for-profit side of that and how that differed from the nonprofit stuff?
For-profit, for us, it was a kind of like underlying business model. When we started out, again, kind of like operating with what's at hand, we did not have connection to personal money. So it was really like a problem-solving question. You know, we started out as both kind of like an art space and a music space in its early history. So it was kind of a natural thing to do. And it also was what worked practically. At some point, like its nonprofitness, grant funding, fundraising took over and allowed for the for-profit to kind of just fade away, which was also necessary. It sort of added up to an organization, but on its own, none of the things could have done that.
I guess this is kind of going back to something that you said about structuring in such a way that it wasn't dependent on any particular person, which I feel like in many ways, maybe we're on the other side of that somehow. It's now like very clear in a concrete way to all of us that the organization will ideally like outlive us all. So like succession, yeah. And that like imagining what we're doing beyond each of us as people has been like a sort of like a conceptual mountain to climb for us. And it really kind of changes our orientation to what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, I'm curious, kind of jumping back to something you were talking about earlier. What were the phases, or when did you kind of like have to disidentify with being like, this is my artist practice and this is an organization?
Certainly, like when I left Iowa. The reason I was in Iowa in the first place was for grad school. And when we started all this, I was like, oh, like I'll just stay in Iowa as long as this project exists. And then I think just at the end of my 2 years, I just really need to be around people of color, like more of them, more of the time. And I ended up landing that gig in New York. And then we had to have this conversation around like, okay, if I move all the way to the East Coast and I'm not just like a quick driving distance away, do we just stop doing it? At that time, we're just so blown away by the reception and kind of how well the first 2 years had gone that it felt really arbitrary to stop. But that was like the first step of imagining the cast program without my constant presence.
There's all these like individual moments, right? Where you're like talking about like, how do you make it work? Do you have to like bend your life around this organization? Right. You know, I think that's very hard for a person or a group of people who have like an idea and found something, it becomes shaped around them in really intense ways, in beautiful ways. But it's often really hard, I think, to imagine their shape without it being kind of shaped around individual or group.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk more about Counterpublics, because it was like part of the Luminary before. Now it has spun off to such an extent that you are sort of just at Counterpublics. Like, did you see that coming at all, or what led to that?
Yeah, so Counterpublic started as a project of the Luminary in 2019. It was meant to be a kind of anti-triennial in a lot of ways. Like, what if you take this model, but instead make it for your neighbors instead of the art worlds? We did it, and then it was kind of like to do it again. I remember the co-curator of 2019, who's still involved, Catherine Simone Reynolds, we were like talking about it, and we were like, we can't ever do it like that again. It's got to stand on its own. And it just sort of like needed to be an organization. Financially, team-wise, it was the way to avoid burning everyone out trying to do everything. So it's been like a multi-year process of trying to like me step out of the Luminary, hand it off, set up this other organization, which has like very different founding scale. But again, it's kind of like not repeating the let's just make it happen no matter what personal cost or what like time and giving. It's kind of one answer to like, no, I wouldn't do it again. That doesn't mean I won't found a thing. I just need like, I have different eyes open in terms of what founding something means in a way that can support people more holistically.
This was as cool as I thought it was going to be, this conversation.
Yeah, it's great. It was short, it went so fast.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's lots more that I'm curious to ask you about that.
We'll find our ways.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Common Work, Learnings for the Future from Common Field. This project was produced with Chris Tyler and Raquel Dutois, graphic design by Alexis Smithrick, and copy editing by Nicolet Duque. Jack Straw Cultural Center recorded, edited, and produced this podcast series. Common Work, Learnings for the Future from Common Field, was developed and curated by Sheethal Prajapathy in collaboration with the Common Field team.
Theme music by Josh Nucci. Common Field would like to thank the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, whose significant and ongoing support of the organization has made this work possible since 2013.